Is it Mr. West?
Morning, Your Honor.
Good morning to you, and Mr. List, again, good morning to you. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin?
Oh, Your Honor.
Mr. West, you may approach and you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Todd West, and I represent the appellant, James Godek. We are appealing his conviction for a single count of terroristic threats out of the Sarpy County District Court. Our case was tried to a jury. Our assignments of error all turn on the trial court's interpretation of the terroristic threat statute, specifically defining the elements of the offense. The trial court held that another person has to be the recipient and actually receive the threat in order for the offense to be completed. We disagree that receipt is a material element of the offense, and we maintain that the offense is complete the moment the actor utters the threat. So as I hope to explain here in a moment...
Let me understand that. So if you were to make a threat right now in an empty room, the crime has been committed. Is that your position?
It would be my position under the interpretation of the plain language of the statute. Now, of course, it would be up to the fact finder to look at the circumstances to see if I possessed the intent to actually terrorize someone, as is also a requisite for the mens rea of the statute. Okay. But we analyze, you know, the completion of the offense based off the actor's conduct alone under the interpretation I'm proposing today.
To take Justice Frydenberg's example to another level, he asked you about utterance in an empty room where presumably there's no one listening. Supposing the person merely thinks the threat, has a crime been committed then?
Well, I do believe that there is, I think my answer to that would probably be no.
So utterance is required?
I do believe that threaten is the active verb in this case, and that you have to utter or verbalize it in some way. It has to become manifest. So that would be my follow-up to that question.
But yet you take the position, and you agree. You said at the outset, and I think very candidly, that all of your assignments of error turn on the issue that we're talking about.
Yes, indeed they do.
Okay. So you're taking the position that while it has to be uttered, there doesn't have to be someone who hears it.
Correct.
Okay, that's your interpretation.
What is our earlier case law, if any, say about that?
Well, all of the case law, frankly, supports our position that the crime of terroristic threats isn't concerned with the result produced by the threat, and it doesn't actually require the threat to cause someone to feel terrorized. So I think that supports our position that the crime as it's defined and under the statute defines it in terms of the actor's conduct alone and not towards who the conduct is acted upon. I mean, if you contrast that with other penal statutes that use more transitive verbs, which is simply a verb that requires an object to receive action. For example, the child enticement statute says you can't solicit a child, and the intimidation by phone statute says you can't telephone an individual. The actus reus in those statutes defines it in terms of who's receiving the actor's conduct, and that's not what you see with the terroristic threat
under
statute.
Your interpretation, who's the victim?
I don't think that this crime is defined to include a victim per se. That may sound novel and it may be presumed. I think that in some opinions it is presumed that there is a victim, but I haven't found any ruling that does actually define this to be a crime against the person of another with actually a named victim.
It's a victimless crime.
That's our position, the way the statute is worded.
How does it ever get reported?
Well, there is a point where, and it's going to be the time when it's received, that it's reported to authorities and that it's referred to for prosecution. But I think that the lower court's interpretation of the statute conflates the elements of the statute with the process of how a state goes about proving with evidence that the offense occurred.
You think that the use of the telephone makes any substantive difference? And let me posit as an alternative, in the hypothetical, that had this occurred where your client's standing on one side of the state line and the person hearing him is on the other side of the state line, but everything else is the same. Does the telephone make a difference?
Well, the telephone is what allows the actor to be outside of the state and potentially be heard in another state, in this case Nebraska. But it makes no difference because the crime is completed once it comes out of the actor's mouth. It's not completed and you have to wait for the message to get to a recipient or someone who can actually hear it and report it to the police or report it to a prosecutor. I think that there's some if a tree falls in a wood type high-level thinking here, but yes, you do have to have evidence to prove that the crime occurred. I'd also point out what I said earlier, that a lot of this actor's intent you have to infer from words and actions. And if you're not making a threat that anyone hears, I guess there is a legitimate question of whether the person intended for his or her conduct to actually terrorize somebody. So it does create a novel question about whether there's a victim or whether someone has to hear it, but if we're looking at the strict language of the statute, it's not required.
Did I hear you argue that threaten is not a transitive verb?
It's defined both transitively and intransitively.
I mean, isn't it usually have an object? I mean, well, I can't go outside and just threaten. I threaten a person.
You can also yell without having a direct object. And I think if you look at the dictionary,
that sounds like yelling, not threatening.
I'm trying to provide an example of how it can be transitively and intransitively defined.
So if you're just letting off steam, is that a crime?
I would argue no. If this was my jury trial before the jury, that we can infer from his words and actions and those who were in the vicinity that that was not the accused state of mind to have the intent to terrorize another or act with reckless disregard of the risk of causing that type of terror. I think that the electronic communication statute that was passed to amend the venue statutes subsequent to this conviction, by the way, at least educates us on what the legislature thought the terroristic threat statute could do and could not do. Initially, LB 500 in 2021 proposed to modify the language of the terroristic threat statute for a crime committed with an electronic communication device. Venue's appropriate wherever it's in the communications initiated or where it's received. If you look at the testimony from the committee hearings, they had a major problem with jurisdiction being affected by this legislation because, in effect, it would criminalize someone's conduct outside of the state. They even referred to this scenario, an actor in Iowa calling someone in Nebraska and the laws of our state criminalizing that actor's conduct when that actor never set foot into Nebraska.
Do other states have similar terroristic threat statutes, and have any of their courts adopted your position that venue would only be, or jurisdiction would only be appropriate in the state where the threat was made?
I've not done a comprehensive survey of that. I know that in Schmeisel, which is cited in both of our briefs, it does look to other Supreme Courts and of other states that have defined the corresponding terroristic threat statute in their states, and not all of them have come up with the conclusion that you're required to threaten another. So I think that that's an open question, and I think that it's language that the court improperly supplied, missing language that's not there, and that's not how we're supposed to interpret penal statutes. We're supposed to interpret them strictly, just the language that's there. So that's why we're asking to vacate the sentence, reverse the conviction, and either dismiss it for jurisdictional issues or remand it with instructions to properly instruct on the law.
And before your time expires, just to be very clear, there is no factual dispute.
There is no factual dispute.
Yes.
That only the sister was in Nebraska, and my client never left the state of Iowa. I'll reserve the 19 seconds that I have.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Liss, good morning again.
Morning again, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Nathan Liss, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the appellee, State of Nebraska. The state maintains that this offense took place in Nebraska and was properly prosecuted here. More specifically, we maintain the offense occurred here in Nebraska because by statute, a terrorist threat must be received by another in order for the offense to be committed. Under 28-311.01, a person commits the offense of terroristic threats if he or she threatens to commit a crime of violence with the intent to terrorize another or in reckless disregard of causing such terror. So the two main components of the offense are, number one, that a threat of violence has been made, and number two, that the actor had the requisite intent of terrorizing another. Both of these components illustrate that another person or recipient must be involved. As far as the first component, the threat of violence, a threat is defined as a communicated intent to inflict harm or loss on another or another's property. By definition, then, as well as a plain and ordinary understanding of the term threat, it is something that is communicated or conveyed to another. So the first component establishes that a recipient or another person must be involved. As far as the second component, the intent to terrorize another, this Court has explained that intent to terrorize another is an intent to produce an intense fear or anxiety in another. The only way an actor could have such intent is for the threat to be communicated or conveyed to another person. Thus, we would submit that the second component of the offense also requires that another person or recipient be involved. In sum, we maintain that the offense does require a recipient in order for the offense to be completed. And in this case, the recipients of the threat, it's undisputed, were in Bellevue, Nebraska when they received the phone calls in question.
Does the mechanism of communication, specifically here telephonic, make any difference?
I don't believe that it does. I mean, I think the requirements are the same. There has to be a threat, and there has to be the requisite intent to
So terrorize. In this particular case, it happened to be someone in a neighboring state. Would the same result apply if it had come from Florida or Paris?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, especially since the key here is that there be a recipient. And then for venue purposes, the crime can be prosecuted where the offense is committed. If the recipient is in a county in Nebraska,
factually,
where it's committed.
Wouldn't it make some difference that in this case, for example, the defendant was apparently in Council Bluffs, close enough to the intended targets of the suggested threats that he could actually carry them out? If the defendant were in Paris, probably the recipient would have hung up the phone and laughed, right?
Well, it might depend on the nature of the threat. I mean, if you're in Council Bluffs and you threaten to go, you know, beat someone who's in Omaha, maybe they feel that is a little bit more imminent than if you made that same phone call from Paris. But if you threaten to kill someone or have their family killed, you might take that call equally serious, whether it's from Council Bluffs or Paris or some other part of the world. So I think that depends on probably the nature of the threat. But the offense doesn't require the victim to actually be terrorized or that the actor has the ability to currently execute that threat. It's just, did the actor have the requisite intent? So I don't know that the location necessarily matters. I mean, it could certainly be relevant to the circumstance, or at least to the finer effect, depending on the nature of the threat and where they're located. But I don't think it affects it from a statutory interpretation standpoint, to the extent that the appellant is attempting to do so. Just briefly, as far as the electronic communication statute, I don't think that has any relevance here. Obviously, it was enacted after the fact. Certainly doesn't apply directly. But to the extent that the appellant is pointing to that and suggesting it supports their position, I would respectfully disagree. I reviewed the legislative history as well, and what was communicated there by the senator who introduced it, as well as our office who supported it, was the fact that the point of this was that some of the or other more current statutes with child enticement and other things have already built this into their statute, the fact that electronic communications can be prosecuted whether they're sent or received. And so the point of this new bill was to just bring other offenses up to speed and clarify, not to make new offenses, as they said. We're not making new offenses. We're just clarifying that venue would apply the same with other offenses, such as terroristic threats and others. And to the extent there was some questions about jurisdiction, it didn't really have any bearing on that. There was, I don't know what the original language of the bill, how it read, but some of the senators seemed to not understand jurisdiction or the fact that if a single element of offense occurs here, that we have jurisdiction, and they were seeming to understand or seeming to think that this bill was doing something that it wasn't, that it was expanding notions of jurisdiction or creating jurisdiction or new offenses, which it was not doing. But none of that shows that the legislature was intending to create a new offense here or expand venue or jurisdiction, which is essentially what the appellant's arguing, to show that the legislature would have presumably thought beforehand that terroristic threats was not, you know, couldn't be interpreted that way, that it would occur only where it was sent. It's simply not the case.
Have we ever said that proposed legislation that doesn't pass has any impact upon our decisions? What kind of input does that have for us?
Well, this did pass.
I'm sorry. The most recent thing, the most recent one passed.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the original language was. I think it did go through and get tweaked a bit before it was finally passed. But I mean, to answer your question, I'm not aware of any authority or really any instance in which you've addressed legislation that didn't pass and so it had any effect. I mean, I guess to the extent it doesn't pass and then some changes are made and things are tweaked, you know, that could affect legislative intent or show what they meant or didn't mean. But if it's not passed, it's not passed, and it's done. If there are no further questions, we would ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 17 seconds.
17 seconds. We'll give you 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your
Mr.
Honor.
Mr. West.
When the state highlights the definition of threat as a communicated intent to inflict harm, and then it links it up with the state of mind requirement for this statute, which is intent to terrorize another, I think their conclusion is somewhat conclusory without a lot of reasoning that it necessitates a recipient. And I think that that's one thing that I didn't really mention about the way the state goes about defining this for the court in its briefs. It's somewhat conclusory. So I think when you look to those definitions and they link it up with the state of mind, I don't think that necessarily implies that the action must be received by somebody else. So yes, we do stand by our position that no victim is required to prove this offense.
Thank you. That concludes arguments in State versus Godick. Counsel, you are excused. The court is now going to take a 10-minute break, so the court will return at 10:40, and then handle the last two cases of the day. I am recused on both of those cases, so Justice Miller-Lerman will be presiding, and the court will be joined by Judge Marsh, District Court Judge from the 9th Judicial District. With that in mind, we will take a 10-minute recess. Thank you.